afternoon, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. It's Monday again, the 13th of March. There was sun yesterday. Did you guys go out and plant things in your yard?
Absolutely not.
What?
We need to work on you.
Okay.
Well, so we don't have our members here yet, so we'll wait to do the work session. Let's start by opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 246.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 246 clarifies the Department of Human Services' authority to immediately suspend, revoke, or replace conditions on a child caring agency's license. It establishes a procedure to rescind the notice of intent to revoke or suspend a license for a child caring agency if DHS determines that the conditions warranting suspension or revocation have been resolved. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is also a -2 amendment posted, and it clarifies the requirements for placing conditions on a child caring agency license. It also changes who DHS consults with in making a decision to rescind a notice of intent to revoke a license. And it also allows DHS to rescind a notice of intent to revoke a license unilaterally after January 1st, 2023. And it also removes the emergency clause and replaces it with an effective date of the 91st day after sine die.
Great. So I wanted to give a little background on this. We've got some folks in the room that can help us out a little bit. But this is the last of the niggly pieces around Senate Bill 1515 and the child caring agencies. And if you remember from the bill that we passed last session, there are four things that happen that are, you know, really bad things. If they occur, the statute says that the department has to revoke the license of the agency. That's if a child dies because of abuse of there is abuse that's known to the agency. The agency knows the child is being physically or sexually abused and does not intervene to stop it and fails to report it. The third is interfering with or refusing to participate in an investigation, any kind of investigation. And the fourth is around kind of the embezzlement issue that we talked about last time, the refusal to provide documents. So after what became clear was that we need some sort of an off-ramp for the department when an organization has been able to ameliorate the circumstances that led to the big bad thing that occurred. And Senate Bill 246 is what attempts to do that. There have been a lot of conversations about this for a very, very long time. We had a final work group meeting on Friday, and we had Clyde, Dr. Richardson, Representative Olson, Representative Sanchez's office was there. I don't think you ended up being able to join us. Doug was there. I was there. Somebody, and Laura Smith was there as well. And I think we came to a pretty good place. I'll describe what these are. We needed to make a couple of modest tweaks to the -2 amendment that is in there. But basically, the way that this would work is the thing happens, the letter of intent to revoke is issued just like it is today. But if the director determines that he doesn't or she doesn't want to revoke the license, she convenes a panel that is herself and the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And if it is a psychiatric facility or medical facility, the medical director of the Oregon Health Authority. If the three, if that panel agrees that it should be lifted, they sign a letter to the governor 2 weeks in advance saying we have agreed that we should rescind the letter of revocation. And that letter will describe both what happened, how the problem was ameliorated, and why they believe that it is a safe and great place to serve kids. And then after that, they rescind the letter of revocation. For the first 3 years after that, the agency would have an annual licensing visit instead of a biennial licensing visit, which means one extra visit in that middle year. The changes to, and the other thing that this adds, and this was a request as well, we want to make sure that when the department is putting conditions on a provider that due process is available to that provider and that the conditions are closely tailored to the problems that the agency is having. So we added language in that's in the -2 that kind of points to the Administrative Practices Act, and that kind of triggers straight to the ability for a speedy for an expedite, not speedy, that's Judiciary Committee, expedited hearing, that's administrative hearings. The changes that we would make to the dash two that are in there is removing some language that we determined was not needed around considering the liability to the state that didn't make sense to include, and the language had directly said that the department could consult with the Attorney General or the Department of Justice. They can do that anyway, so that is extraneous language. And after much discussion, we went through the exercise of removing the emergency clause. The work group decided we would like to add the emergency clause so that the department has the authority. So that's the content, and then I would invite anybody that wanted to say anything about it. But are there questions?
Yeah, so, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So what we have now is dash two.
Correct.
And there's a dash three that's being developed?
Yes, there will be a dash three.
Okay.
And so that will be both dash two and dash three?
No, it will just be the
dash three.
Okay. It will just be the dash three.
And the dash three is the result of the meeting that happened on Friday?
Correct. Correct. And I believe you have, you should have received a letter today from
yes.
Janet Ahrens of the Alliance that indicated comfort from the Alliance with those amendments as well.
I thought the dash two was a...
The dash two is what we talked about, and then at the meeting we wanted to take out some language and re-add the emergency clause. So that's...
Okay.
So the dash three will be very similar to the dash two, but tweaked. It will add back the emergency clause, remove the reference to consultation with the AG because it's unnecessary, and remove language about considering future liability to the state because how do you do that?
Yeah, I would just say thank you, Madam Chair, for and everyone who is involved in those conversations. It's great to see this move forward.
And there have been a lot of people, I think, especially want to thank Representative Andy Olson, who's been working really hard on this issue, and Doug and others, and Laura Smith. Dr. Richardson, did you want to say anything from the department about anything or not?
I think you've summarized it perfectly, and so we'll let it stand.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 246?
So when do we expect the dash three?
Well, I realized when Matt was reading the summary that I asked for an amendment to the dash one. So hopefully I can get an email to the Legislative Council, or she can read my mind and figure out that I made a mistake. But hopefully we can have this ready to move by Wednesday or Monday. Is that reasonable to everybody?
Well, if it can't be today, I guess it'll have to be.
you must have more power than I do, because I can't get amendments.
You can't get amendments?
No, they're not coming out very fast.
Have you tried chocolate?
It's not good for me.
Not for you, oh, as yeah. a gift.
Oh, I should work on the content of your amendments.
Okay, is there anything else about this bill that anybody would like to talk about? No? Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 246. And next, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 819.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 819 expands the duties and responsibilities of critical incident response teams assigned to investigate the fatality of a child that resulted from abuse. It establishes the membership of the team. It requires the DHS to supply the team with all available records and information, and establishes requirements for case review records maintenance. It also requires the team to submit an initial progress and final report to DHS within specified timelines. The measure requires the team to recommend to DHS improvements to the child welfare system specific to the case under review. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
So I would like to go sit with Stacy to do this. Could you take this?
Oh, my gosh.
Senator?
Have a good afternoon, you guys.
Just don't hit me with it. Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, and this button is bothering me, which includes Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, Tangent, Millersburg, and unincorporated areas. So Senate Bill 819 relates to, and I'd like to thank Senator Olson for being a co-sponsor on this bill, relates to critical incident response teams. These are teams that get together, they convene to look at the systemic issues related to a child fatality. So if you go all the way back to about 2005 or 2006, Governor Ted Kulongoski instituted the idea of these CERTs. They were voluntary at the time because there had been a number of high-profile child welfare incidents. In 2007, I believe Senator Knope was here and Senator Montes Anderson was here, we passed Carley's Law. Carley's Law made the CERTs mandatory when they're was a fatality of a child that had had contact with the department in the prior 24 months, prior 12 months. 12 months, thank you. Original proposal was 24, but we took it back to 12. So since that time, a number of CERTs have been done. Some have been more effective than others, and I would really commend Clyde Psyche, who's the, as you know, our new director of the Department of Human Services, who really has revamped the format and the detail that is inside the CERTs. And if you go back, they're all publicly posted. You can see that the last three or four CERTs that have been posted have very significant detail inside of them, and they list kind of measurable things that need to get done with a plan to reconvene later to look at how these pieces can get put together. However, it became clear in looking at a number of CERTs over the last 2 years and in conversations with the department that we could strengthen the CERTs. And that is what Senate Bill 819 seeks to do. There are changes that need to be made. Stacy's going to talk to some of them, but I wanted to walk you through a couple of the key elements of the bill. The first is that the language that we currently have in statute around what's a mandatory CERT and what is a discretionary CERT is not adequate for the cases that we need to be picking up. So right now, it is a mandatory CERT if there actually was an assessment on a child when there was a fatality. This language would make any contact with the department. So for instance, if there had been a series of telephone calls about that child to the child welfare hotline and they had all been closed at screening, under current law, that would not fall into a mandatory CERT. Under this one, we would be able to go back and say, hey, we had six calls about this kid. We never went out and did an assessment. We need to look at what happened in that case. What might we have done in terms of the reporting or the assessing at that screening? The other problem that came up is that the law, as it's currently written, is very specific. It talks about that particular child. But children live within family systems. So you could have a circumstance where you had a child that died, and there was no contact with that particular child in the prior 12 months, but there were reports on each of his three siblings or on two other children that lived in the same home. So you'll see in sub D, it talks about that the mandatory search is triggered if other children in the home have also been a subject of that assessment. So that's the first key thing. The language here talks about appointing the members of the critical incident response team within 24 hours. This was aligned with the protocol that the department had adopted and been working in under for a few years. We've had discussions and think that should be pushed out a little bit longer. It takes some time to gather the information to name the members of the team. The bill also expands who it is that's on the CERT. So right now, the CERT is primarily DHS personnel. The bill proposes to add some public members to this to add just a different set of eyes into these conversations. And it recommends, the bill asks for a CASA who is not personally involved in the case, just because those CASAs who are seeing things from a different perspective and what you're looking at in these CERTs, it's not a blame finding, it's not a personnel thing. It really is looking at the system issues. A CASA will ask different questions from the perspectives that he has had. A member of the local citizen review board, again, that's another set of eyes, and then a senator and a representative. The reason for that is that when the department goes through these systemic issues, these are very confidential processes, and there is information that could be very helpful in the development of policy that the department is not able in another format to openly share. And I can say that in a discretionary way, I've recently been able to participate in a CERT, and it's been very helpful to me to see an actual case play out as we think about the issues that we have here, even though I can't talk about what I learned. the bill Those really are the key pieces of the bill. The rest of this kind of outlines the protocol that currently is in the rule. It does clarify that the current rule that the department adopted that built on their protocol said that if you started the cert and it turned out that it was a single employee or a group of employees, you could stop the cert and you did not need to complete it. This says that you would need to complete that because that can be a systemic issue. If you're looking at a mistake in a branch or a mistake with a worker, part of that systemic issue is looking at what can you do to avoid that mistake in the future.
Question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am, please.
Thank you. I noticed that in G, you have a state senator appointed by the president of the Senate and a state representative. When we get involved in actual specific cases, I've been on reviews before, and sometimes they're very involved, and I don't know if it would be nice if it wasn't required to have a state senator and a state representative. I mean, could this go on in case the senator or the representative couldn't show up? I mean, I'm just nervous about the time commitment.
So Chair Olson and Senator Montes-Anderson, I believe that that's the case. The member would need to be appointed, but the rule that the department adopted prior to the cert that I participated in stated that only the member could participate and could not send a delegate, but we can make sure that the language is clear that it would not stop the cert process if any member of the cert did not come.
Thank you.
If I may, for clarification, is a senator appointed on a specific cert only, or is there the appointed for a length of time?
Chair Olson, this does not state that, but hopefully we don't have a lot of certs, and it would be dependent on the timing. I think going to Senator Montes-Anderson's question, when people are available to participate, it will depend on when these come up. You can't really plan when these things are going to occur. So I would imagine it would be for each individual cert. And I think there are places where, you know, you might have a member, if you had the same member appointed all the time, two problems that I could anticipate if that was an issue in their district. There's a lot of confidential information, and I don't know that it would be appropriate for a member to be on a cert where they had contact with the individuals that were there in a personal level. And I also think that there is a benefit of cycling through different members to be able to have a better grasp of what these issues are and to better understand some of the challenges that are faced in the system.
So I'll do my own follow-up. So basically what you're saying is that a senator and a representative would be appointed on a case-by-case basis.
Chair Olson,
you make
yes.
that clear in the amendment? Or because it's really not kind of, it's really not, and at least in my opinion, it's not very clear. It says it would be appointed, and I've been appointed, and that lasted a year.
Interesting.
So
yeah.
Sure.
Chair Olson, members of the committee, that's a great question. I think that the way that the statute reads, it could be perceived, and I'll get myself on the record here in a minute, it could be perceived that every time a new cert is declared, that happens again, that the Senate president appoints a member at that point. It's not a standing, committal at that point. That's the way we would interpret it, is that each time it would have to be a recognition that this cert has been declared and we need a person to be appointed to be on the cert.
Well, first off, would you please identify
yes.
yourself?
There you go. So, Stacey Ayers, I am the Child Protective Services Manager for the department, and thank you for the opportunity to talk today.
Okay, so then I'll ask another follow-up. If the senator or representative or both are appointed per each case, who in this group of people actually will be consistent with every case so that you have a consistent hierarchy and a consistent means of examining each case so that you don't have people that haven't done it before, everybody's never done it before, and all of a sudden they're on this group. How do you get over that hump?
Well, Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you again for that question. I think that it is, again, you're operating from the premise that you would, I think, would want it to be the same person so that you don't get any crossover, you have consistency. And I guess my concern would be that you'd want people that aren't, you'd want others to participate to be able to see this.
Let me clarify my question. You've got this team, this CERT team. Mm-hmm. Are all of the members going to be new every time?
No.
Or will some members be consistent in the fact that they know what the requirements are and the paperwork that has to be filled out and the examinations that need to be done? Will they be consistent, or every time we do this we get 5, 10, or whatever the number is, new people?
Right. Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you again for the question. I think that the way that it reads, you would have consistent members from the department involved.
Okay.
And you would have potentially some fluctuation in who the other members are. It's, member of the Senate as appointed by the Senate president, for instance. I think... and then depending upon where the actual incident happened, because this is all predicated on the fact that you've got a child who died due to abuse or neglect, right? And so that may happen in a different county. So maybe in one instance it happens in Lane County, and then later there's another incident that happened in Multnomah County. And so that would change the representatives from the local office. And that happens now. But there will also be a set group of people that are involved in it. For instance, me. I'm on every CERT. And there have been some that I've not been not participated in. And perhaps it was in the past because of a conflict. Like I used to supervise somebody who was now in a position. Or I was on vacation, right? And can't predict these things, as the senator pointed out. So.
I do. Thanks,
please.
Mr. Chair. Right now, legislators are not on CERTs, but you've been on a CERT, Senator Gelzer, but it's not part of the statute. Is that right?
Correct. Chair Olson, Senator Dembro, 1 second.
Did I approve that?
Maybe I'll take I'll give it a whirl.
Thank you.
So, Chair Olson, Senator
Did she just
Dembro.
Tell you that she was going to give you chocolate to answer the question?
She did not.
I delivered cannoli one day.
I appreciate the struggle in this, in particular the question to the senator at this point about these things, because I think she's really trying to do her best not to compromise some of the things that have happened and really be thoughtful about the confidential nature of some of the things that there has been an allowance recently for some members that wouldn't ordinarily be on the CERT committee. It's not required by statute. It was a situation where we believe that there was some benefit to having some outside members that don't ordinarily sit on the CERT process. And so it was an unusual type of request, and I think it was beneficial from a number of different perspectives, but it isn't something that historically we have done. To get at your question, that was the reason. It's very unique. It's not something that we've done before.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to have to think just personally whether I think that's a good idea to have a legislator there or not a good idea. We have the question, as the senator raised, do we want it to be a new person for each time? Do we want it to be someone representing the area in which that death happened? At some point I'd like us to talk more about that.
And I'll do a follow-up to that. I would just question, what is the necessity of a senator or a representative to be there? Because this is more of a legal issue rather than a legislative issue, and the question comes about then, why would a senator or a representative need to be present for this? Because there obviously won't be any legislation coming out of it, and it's probably most of us, maybe with the exception of yourself, Madam Chair, and the good Lori Monas Anderson down there, are not trained in any of this. So the question is, why would we be present?
Chair Olson, Senator Dimbrough, I think there's a good reason to be present, and that's it really is not a legal process. It is a debrief. It is designed to be a debrief of something that went wrong in a process to determine how, whatever it is that went wrong, if there's a systemic issue, that can be corrected in the future. Some of those things, sometimes there may be statutory impediments to the work that needs to be done. I think certainly in the process of ASSERT, as I understand the process of ASSERT to work, there would be a lot of listening. It's not that the members of the ASSERT team are, it really is looking at patterns within the agency and policy and how can things be improved. And some of those may lead to legislation, may help better underscore budgetary types of needs, leadership or structural kinds of needs. And it is an opportunity for a legislator in the agency to see information in a way that you otherwise might not be able to be. And the idea would be, you know, prior to serving on this CERT, I had a conversation with Clyde about the challenge sometimes where you have legislators trying to do things. The agency has information that would be very helpful to tell us, but they can't because it's locked in that confidentiality cube. This creates that mechanism for that type of very frank conversation that's not hypothetical, that's not anecdotal, that's actually based in fact.
Well, I don't want to be a negative Nelly, but if you take Senator or Representative that does not sit on this committee and understand the inner workings of this bill, and you get somebody from finance because they don't know anything, and I say that with tongue in cheek, the fact is that they wouldn't understand this process whatsoever. And I don't know how they would understand, other than the fact that they've been thrown into a critical situation, how they would understand through discussion what we need to change to fix it.
And Chair Olson, members of the committee, I think that is why we rely on that appointment by the Senate President and the Speaker. I mean, I don't think they're going to go pick an Ag and Natural Resource person and just toss them in there to have
someone.
It would be me.
And Michael.
I think the presiding officers are relatively thoughtful, and I know in the past.
can I quote you on that?
Yeah. please tell the Senate President that I.
Hello, Mr. President. Mr. President.
Just don't tell him I said he was cheerful.
Sorry.
That's okay. What were we talking about?
We were talking about why
yeah,
senators
that the choices would be
the choices would be they'd be thoughtful. And in the past, whether it's this type of a thing, other types of work groups that happen with the Department of Human Services or others, it's not unusual for the department to be having a conversation with the presiding officer around. It would be very helpful for us if we could work with this person. Because depending on the situation, there could be people that are working on some of those issues that it would be helpful for those folks to be there. And I do think that when you have people that are in a room discussing a situation about systems, and you have people in the room that are not always working in that system on a day-to-day basis, the perspective is going to be different. The questions that are asked will be different and can trigger a different kind of conversation around the table rather than if it's just the same people.
Senator Monas Anderson.
Yeah. I served on the MDT from Clackamas County. Some heavy-duty cases. This was back in the 90s. And that's not a CERT, but that is where we took cases, those that have died, and reviewed the cases. And I was there as a public health nurse. It would have been very strange for me to have a state rep or a state senator there wondering why they are there. We, as an MDT anyway, we would come up with what we saw might have been missing or you know, more research on this. But if anything came out of that, then we would advocate with the agency for possible legislation. I don't know. I served with Senator Cruz and Senator Representative Krieger and myself on a case. And it was very difficult. We had long meetings, two or three different times, and there were opinions of the legislators that didn't necessarily coincide with the agency's opinions on things, and then it becomes a political process. So, you know, I'm ambivalent. Because a death of a child is a horrendous thing, and we need to be treating it with care. And I want to make sure the right people are at the table.
And Chair Olson, Senator Modest Anderson, it's a fairly structured process with relatively high level people from the department that are engaging in the discussions, and the way that it is structured and it works, it's really not a political process. Ultimately, it's the department that writes the report at the end. It's not a process where people are voting or can leave and go out and talk about what has happened in that case. What you have at the end is the report that comes out, and you can go and read these. You can go and read the reports online. But I would like to follow up later. I'd like to have a further conversation with Stacy to figure out how I can talk about what we just did and be appropriate in doing so. There are two other elements to the bill that are really important. Could I hit those before we...
You can, but I have another question along those lines. In reading this, we've got the director, which is appropriate. We've got the lead department services personnel. We've got... Why do we need... someone from media and communications?
Well, I'll take a shot
Please,
at that
Stacey.
One. So, Senator Olson, members of the committee, again, thank you for the question. I think that it is general. Generally, we'd like to have a person from our media or communications group. That sounds all fancy and everything, but it's really just a person who can say, there have been a number of different reports, articles in the paper, or perhaps news stories that have been released about a fatality, perhaps, and it's really to kind of be coordinated in our approach to releasing information so that there's a single point of contact that. If the local branch is getting requests for information, that they can actually forward that on to the person at central office, perhaps that handles those. So it's really just about trying to be thoughtful about how that information is released and who's the point. So.
I can understand it. Thank you.
Yeah, just following up on that. I mean, the way this is written, it says that the people on the cert shall include, at a minimum, the following. Mm-hmm. And so you still have the ability to add additional people.
Sure.
And, you know, that may be something to think about. It may not always be necessary to have the media and communications person there, but at times there may be. So that might be something that, case-specific, you might want to add that person.
Yeah, and Chair Olson, Senator Dembro, you're absolutely right. We generally will have them there regardless. So even if they're not in specifically mandated by statute, they would be there anyway. And if for no other reason, just to say there have been no reports, there have been no inquiries, there have been no real media attention for a case. And that happens actually pretty consistently. You would think there would be more inquiry about specific child fatalities, but they don't always rise to that level. So, nevertheless, they are there to say, no, there's been no inquiry.
And before we continue on, I would just as a suggestion that we huddle up on G, the state senator and representative, mm-hmm. to kind of clarify that. I think there's been enough focus on that now that there's could be some concern. So please continue.
Thank you. So the two other pieces that I wanted to mention, the current CERT law allows for district attorney and law enforcement to participate. Where that came from in the statute was when we worked on Carly's law back in 2007, and there actually was not, Carly did not have a CERT. There was never a CERT done for Carly. And at that time, the Benton County District Attorney had a lot of information that came to light during the investigation of that office, as did law enforcement. But we were writing this after sentencing, so that the entire process had been complete. What's become clear since that time is that there's very important information that that law enforcement and a district attorney could offer into a process at the right time. It is not appropriate necessarily for a district attorney to be called into a CERT while they are in the process of discovery, because you don't want them coming into information in an inappropriate way that would then compromise the investigation. So there would be an amendment to this bill that really pushes that back. And what I'm hoping that we can come up with is language that you know, kind of consistent with what Clyde has done with the CERTs, where you're going to come back later and check on, have we made progress on these tasks that we identified out of this CERT. At the end of the prosecution, the DA could come back and there could be a little bit of a debrief of, this is what the department found the systemic issues were. This is what the DA would layer on top from kind of that more comprehensive investigation that has more resources out there. So that would be in there. The other piece, and I can let Stacy talk at this at more length, because he's done the really good work of finding language from Washington that would help us do this. It's very important that these CERT reports are transparent. This really is a method of oversight about a very important issue, and we want to shine as much light on it as we can, which also goes back to the Senator and Representative piece, because we do have an oversight role, and this is part of that. But we also don't want the reports to be used as in a tort claim where you just go and you hand it over and say, here's my case. So Stacy's done some good work helping to find some language that the fatality review teams in Washington State use that address those issues. And I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit more, but sure, that will be in a future amendment.
So as we noted, I'm Stacy Ayers with the Child Protective Services Program. I manage the program for the department. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about the bill today. I've had an opportunity to meet with Senator Gelser and have a lot of conversations, and as she's mentioned, these are there are elements of the bill that we think are really solid and would do good, a lot in the way of good for children, and there are some amendments that we would like to put forward for the reasons that she's noted. I'm not going to go through every section of the bill, but I'll just kind of talk about some of the things that were potentially could be problematic, and at the same time, there are elements of the language that would be beneficial. For instance, in the first part of the legislation or this proposed bill, there's the language about a child who is the subject or we became aware of that may have died due to abuse or neglect. That's a change from the past or from the current statute, in that there's the current statute has language about there's been a determination, right? And so this would specifically change that to when the department becomes aware that a child may have died and it's likely due to abuse or neglect. Why that's important is because awareness could start at day one, right? It could be at the time that somebody called in a report and said, hey, I'm out on this, I'm out, there's a fatality, and I'm not sure. Just the fact that I'm a mandatory reporter, I'm going to call it in, even though fatality of itself is not an allegation of child abuse or neglect. But we've trained our partners pretty well in this regard, and so they call kind of regardless. And you could make an argument, I think, pretty effectively that it was at that point that we became aware. And even if even if it's really not an allegation. And so the clock really starts ticking potentially at that point. And the worry we have, and I've expressed this, and I think that there's some flexibility here to kind of work through some of these concerns, is that we would really be calling together a member members, identifying it as a cert, getting members together, and really being, you know, moving forward in a situation where we don't know, in fact, whether or not this is due to abuse or neglect. And in many instances, it's not due to abuse or neglect. And there's some language in the bill that talks about kind of investigating and gathering information, if it's not part of the record, by doing examination of people or materials that may contain information that's not in the original record. And so the concern we would have about that is potentially it would be, you know, law enforcement is looking into this. They're trying to determine what they have. And we would then, or the members of the CERT, would also be investigating. And you have the possibility of kind of getting crossways, I believe, the way that it's written, with law enforcement. I don't believe that that's the intent. And I think that there are some ways we can get around that. And it also potentially could be that you're having to interview law enforcement because they have information that's not included in the original record. So,
Stacy, if I may.
Sure.
Two questions. One, would this CERT group have subpoena power?
Senator Olson, members of the committee, it's not clear in this part of the statute that they would. I believe they would, but it is it does create its own set of questions about what their authority is to kind of bring people in and compel them to answer questions.
And that's the point I'm getting to, because you've got, if there is an allegation of abuse, I assume law enforcement and the DA would be involved, and so this seems to be kind of like a parallel review, not an investigation. So I wondered if, in fact, you would just review files, or you would bring people in and have them testify. And if you didn't have power to subpoena, then you...
Yeah, Senator Olson, members of the committee, again, I think that that's a good question, and I don't want to focus too much on that component of it, because I think that is a piece of the legislation. I think that is there's willing to have some amendments on, because I don't know that that's necessarily the intent.
And then I have one other question for you. If a child dies mm-hmm. of a disease that they could have been vaccinated for, would DHS consider that to be child neglect? They open a cert case.
Senator Olson, members of the committee, so just to kind of get back to the specific language of the bill, the way that the bill reads is that there are a couple pieces to this answer this question. There would have to be, you would have to say that child was actually abused because the parent didn't get them a vaccination. And currently, nowhere in the state that I'm aware of, and I've been working with the department for over 20 years now, and have had a number of conversations about this, and have had medical staff call in specifically to make reports about vaccination, or a child not getting vaccination, not getting immunized. We do not consider that strictly and by itself an allegation of child abuse. Has there ever been a situation, and I'm familiar with some constituents that have raised that as an issue, has there ever been a situation where a doctor says, look, if this child doesn't get a specific kind of treatment, they will die, and that is a medical certainty, that we would look at that and be concerned and potentially assign that as a medical neglect allegation? Because the doctor was so precise in what they were saying, or the medical staff were so precise in what they were saying. And yes, that is a possibility. And, you know, I think about things like, and I promise I'll get to the second part of your question, but I think about things like a parent who the physicians are saying the child, if they would only get their insulin, it will save their life.
You okay?
Yeah.
You're done.
You want some water?
Yeah, I'm all right. I apologize. Those are the kinds of things that we would take into consideration. And there are, there are a number of these cases that we have where, for religious reasons or a variety of other reasons where people will take the position that they don't want their child to get something that we know clearly, and there's just, extensive medical documentation to support that simple treatment would save a child's life. And for whatever the reason, and oftentimes this comes up in religious freedoms kinds of conversations, people make decisions not to. And those, there is a statute that covers that, and we would consider things like that to be an allegation of child abuse, and we would intervene. The second part of the question is, it kind of gets at there would have to have been some other incident that happened. There would have to have been another allegation of abuse in the past 12 months that was investigated by the child who didn't have immunizations and the doctors. The fact set would have to be perfect. You've got a number of people who are expressing to us or saying, this child is going to die if they don't have this happen. And then in the past, there would have had to have been, within the past year, an assessment that was done on that child or another child, a sibling, or another child living in the home, or a closed-loop screening. And that kind of gets into another part of the bill. I think that there are some concerns about the language and maybe trying to shore that up a little bit, but does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair. Thanks. So I'm still a little fuzzy about the timeline for the certs. So, under this proposal, the cert membership would be set within 24 hours of the incident, and then a report has to be done within 60 days, I think, if I'm reading it right. What are we doing now in terms of our certs, in terms of their timelines, and how does this differ?
So, Chair Dembrough, members of the Chair Olson, Senator Dembrough, members of the committee. The way that the language is in this bill, it's pretty much taken out of the existing protocol at the department. I personally don't believe that the timeline should be in statute, except for to the extent that we want to be sure that the reports on the back end are done in a timely way. We don't want to wait for a year or 2 years to have the report out. So it would be my suggestion that the bill really be pretty significantly pared down, leaving a lot to the rule around when do the people get appointed, how quickly does the meeting take place. I mean, a lot of these things we can avoid by just not describing them at all. To me, the key elements are the change in what is the mandatory cert, kind of those changes around the circumstances that are brought in, the public membership, and I will follow up with each of you about that because I have some pretty strong beliefs about that, and this piece about the legal protection, not being able to use it on its own for a cert, and the piece about kind of the conflict with the criminal case. And making sure that we have what we need in statute to ameliorate that and that we are not putting things into statute that make it more difficult.
Right. So just to follow
sure,
up.
Sure.
So what I'm hearing is we may not want the cert to happen too soon because investigations are still underway. So you want to wait until there's something really to talk about, right? Because there's been a preliminary investigation by the department, whatever. But you don't want it to be too long either.
So, Chair Olson, Senator Dembrough, that's one of the reasons why I think it doesn't make a lot of sense to put the timeline in terms of when that first meeting is. into the statute. I think that there's, you want to be thoughtful about the criminal investigation. However, there are other issues that could come up in a cert that could be very timely that could make a difference for kids right away. So an example that I would give is the, and I did not attend the cert, this was a different cert, GJ was released in December. That was a death that took place last April. And one of the things that the CERT team found in doing that work, even before they issued the final report, was that it was very important for kids and youth to have a nurse involved or medical attention involved as they moved from placement to placement to ensure that appropriate medications and medical protocols were followed as they moved on to new caregivers. That was a new policy that the department adopted pretty quickly, even before the CERT was completed, and that was a really important thing that the department learned that is keeping other kids safe. So we also wouldn't want to set it out for too long. If we don't put a timeline in statute, it gives the department the ability to be nimble depending on the circumstances.
I have a question for your nimbleness. In reading it, it says that the child's sibling or any other child living in the household with the child in the last 12 months, I believe, yeah, in the 12 months there. What happens if a child was transferred from one foster parent or one group home to another and then something happened in the group home? Would that still trigger the CERT because this child had moved into there and then some other child was, you know, was injured?
So, Chair Olson, members of the committee, I don't understand the question. So if
you have a child that is
Bob.
Bob. That you just said Bob.
Bob.
Yeah,
let's
you've
call
got,
him Bob.
You've got Bob over here, and he's with one particular household, and he gets moved by DHS to another household, and then the other household, an event happens. Does that trigger the CERT?
Does Bob die?
No, Bob doesn't. Someone else in the house does. Jim or Sarah.
I think it would probably...
Well, I'm just wondering, because if you look at it, it says if any other child living in the household with a child had a pending child welfare adoption case with the department within the 12 months preceding the fatality. So if someone moved in, they were new there, mm-hmm. but something happened in that new home, mm-hmm. Would that trigger the CERT?
Chair Olson, members of the committee, I think that's an astute look, and it depends. It could be that the child Bob, who is in the foster placement or some other substitute care placement, that they got there for some reason. For instance, there was a child abuse allegation that was investigated related to Bob. And because of that child abuse allegation, they were placed into foster care. Kind of the type of placement may be less relevant just in terms of the conversation, but if that investigation that happened that placed Bob into foster care happened within 12 months of what was our other child's name that passed away?
Jim,
within Jim passing away. Then yes, it would. Then the CERT would apply. It's possible that there's a scenario would be that it wouldn't apply, depending upon how long ago. And to kind of get at another element of this that is potentially problematic is that there's some emphasis here, and I appreciate the emphasis because it's currently something that's discussed in the current statute. It's this within 12-month period, right? So a situation that occurred within 12 months, known to the agency, known to the department, and that would involve things like a child abuse investigation, an assessment, I think is the way it's referred to, or an investigation is the way it's referred to in this. Or in some way there was an adoption case or some other type of case where the department was involved with the sibling or another child that lived in the home, et cetera. The closed-at screening piece it's really broad. And you could potentially have a child who dies. We become aware that the child died maybe due to abuse or neglect. And they had a sibling. Or some other child that lived in the home. It could be that their sibling is 25, say. Just throw that age out. Bob is 25 years old. And when Bob was a year old,
there was a report that was received by the department that was closed to screening, that would actually cause the CERT, if we're following this, would cause the CERT to apply. We'd have to call a CERT in that situation for something that happened 25 years ago. And we don't want that. I don't believe.
Right. I think we just need to add the words in the D. It's all intended to be within the 12 months. But I would also add, in the case of Bob and Jim, yes, a CERT would be called because they're in substitute care. And if Jim was in substitute care, already the statute requires a mandatory CERT in existing law of a child in the custody of the department at the time of death.
Just trying to make sure that if a child has been reviewed by DHS, that just trying to ascertain if that child being reviewed, if his record travels wherever he travels. And that's, I guess that's kind of where I'm going, is does his record travel with him? Does he have this in his portfolio where every foster care home he goes to would have potential? And I hope that every foster care place that he goes does not have a death of a foster child. But what I'm saying is that it seems like this would carry with him no matter what foster care home he ended up in.
So, Chair Olson, members of the committee, it really wouldn't apply because the CERT would not be called because he was there and he had been the subject of an abuse allegation in the prior 12 months. The CERT would be called because the other foster child in the home died, and under current law, there's a mandatory CERT when a child dies in foster care as a result of abuse and neglect.
And Chair Olson, members of the committee, just to kind of address that piece and where I was going with the foster care placement or the other non-family type setting could be, there are children who are in placements, they're not always department children, right? So the way that this is currently written, if they are not in care because of our placement, but the family has in some way placed a child into a residential treatment program because of their, maybe they aren't able to handle the child's special needs, I don't believe that this applies in that situation if that child's sibling dies. So I think it has to be that the department has some kind of ownership over that.
Certainly.
Other questions?
No.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll go ahead and kind of move through. I think that there are some other pieces of it, and I appreciate that we'll be able to work with the senator and perhaps members of the committee to talk about some of the things that would be important in making this bill really a functional bill that gets at what I think everybody is wanting. Let's see. Some of the other... it clearly expands the list of participants. We've talked about some of the examination and review of records and things like that. There may be some potential that it may violate the way that it's specifically written in the bill. Some of the medical records and other records may actually be protected by HIPAA, some federal laws, and so we may have to have conversations about kind of what that means and how that impacts this particular piece of legislation. And then, clearly there is there's another piece in the legislation that, and I think it was already referred to by Senator Gelser, that refers to the human resources component of it. And I think that there are a number of employee-related laws that are currently in statute that protect human resources and potentially disciplinary actions from being made public. So that would be an area of concern that we'd want to work with the senator on. And then clearly the language about that I've researched and found related to, for instance, the Washington State has some language in their statute that talks about information gathered during the course of a CERT process or the fatality review process, and how that information can be used and preventing it from being used in certain types of litigation or civil or criminal proceedings. So
we would support some amendments that get to that. And with that, I have nothing further. And if you have questions, feel free, which I'm sure you will ask me.
I certainly will, because I have them. When, in reading through this again, and to try to make sure that I understand all of it, we talk about these written reports, mm-hmm. And you've got this team put together. Now, who writes the report? I would assume the team. Who does the logistical part of it? In other words, Mr. Saki's not going to sit at the typewriter and type the report out, neither is most everybody else on the team.
What is a typewriter?
Type. You do it on your keyboard. They won't read it into their little, what do they used to call those machines? Yeah.
Dictaphone.
Dictaphone, yeah. So the question is, now you're bringing in another party that's going to be privy to all this confidential information. How do you assess that, and how do you handle that situation? And who staffs it and who pays for it?
Chair Olson and members of the committee, I think, again, it's a really good question. How things are done now is this has been a process that is, to my recollection, is not, I don't know that there's a specific budget that's been allocated for it. And to some degree, it's been largely staffed out of existing kind of resources. And I think that I could argue fairly compellingly that that has been a large part of the reason that some of the timelines that we hope to ascribe to have not been met. And we have a CERT coordinator, one person, who has other job duties, who's specifically responsible for creating kind of the draft report, and then there are a number of iterations that the report goes through, and just to make sure that it's getting at the specific issues that we want it to address, and the elements of the conversation that occurred in the CERT meeting, that they're captured in a way that will be understandable at a later date. People will be clear about what their functions are. But this is a process that potentially you could run the risk of having more certs because of the way the language is crafted. I did have an opportunity to go back through and look at the just to see if we were applying the specific standard of a child sibling or another child living in the home, how many more certs will we have had, for instance? And the way we looked at it was federal fiscal year 2016. So it's a different 12-month period than just the calendar year, as you guys probably know. And it wouldn't have caused a number, a large increase. There would have been maybe a couple more certs. But I didn't go back to the year before that when there were I think the number was about 27, fatalities that were due to abuse or neglect, as opposed to 19 last year. So it could be that the number would have been a little bit bigger. I suspect that there would be some degree of fiscal on this. I don't know that it would be anything exorbitant, but I think we can work through some of those issues. So, and we're willing to do that.
Well, I would recommend personally that because of the very explicit list that says who's supposed to be involved in this team, that you make another condition that you have someone in there that will do the paperwork,
right?
Because that's not in here, and so without that being in here, and if they're not privy to the discussion when it takes place, then without a good set of notes, mm-hmm. you're not going to get exactly, at least my opinion, you won't get exactly what you want out of it.
So Chair Olson, members of the committee, I think something that's really important to remember about this is an existing process. So the wheels are well oiled in terms of how the process works with the existing coordinator, and you can go online. All of these are posted going back for a number of years, and all of that happened prior to this. I mean, the intent of this
really, truly is making sure that we are picking up those couple extra cases. That's concerning to me and should be concerning to all of us. If we're having child fatalities and we have had contact with the family prior to the fatality and did not intervene, we want to better understand why so that we can fix that. It's just important to remember this bill is not creating a cert process. This is enriching the process that already exists that is working well. But we want to make sure, I want to make sure, that when Clyde retires, we maintain the type of transparency that has been present in the most recent certs, because not to beat up an agency, or it's not a fault-finding process. It's a process to figure out what are the signature events that occur that tell us we've got a kid in danger and how can we improve the system so that we have fewer kids that die in the end.
And I can appreciate that, but in the bill it's very specific about very confidential information, and obviously there is a process that works right now. I wish that would have been explained in the bill, that we're just expanding on the process because you know, I've never been involved in these, but the fact of the matter is that we talk about this limited number of people will run the cert, and I was just wondering, how do we get the logistics done? How do we handle the paperwork, if you will, and which one of those people on that list does the paperwork?
And Chair Olson, members of the committee, I would apologize, because I believe it was an error on my part in wanting to meet the bill drafting deadline. I wanted to be as close to what was currently happening because of that intent on building on. So I just sent the existing protocol, which had a lot more detail in it than needed to be, with the idea that we could pare away. And I believe that all the words on the page make that look a lot more complicated. But these words that you read here on the page, many of them currently are written down in administrative rule, right, and previously were written down in a protocol, and they aren't new.
We're going to make this perfect.
Of course.
That's the goal. Any other questions? Okay.
And I think Kevin Neely.
Well, I thought you'd want to come back up again.
What?
I thought you'd want to come up here. Do you want to stay there?
I'll stay because we're on the next one, too.
Okay. Kevin, would you like to come up?
Sure.
Are you for or against?
Please. Thank you, Chair Olson. For the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We did take a quick, actually, it's safe to say we took a fairly long look at this bill. And we did have some initial concerns that Senator Gelser has already identified. This bill does mandate law enforcement participation in the cert. That hasn't been the practice in the past. And I know that our attorneys who work on these cases and do at times participate in the cert process have had discussions with Senator Gelser. And between the two people sitting to my right and our certified smart people, I think they're going to chart a pretty good course for us to ensure that the fidelity of the criminal investigation isn't compromised by the cert process. There appears to be a relatively simple path that will be acceptable to us, and we'll look forward to seeing amendments to make sure that works.
Any questions? Of course, I have one.
Yeah.
These members of the cert team, can they be subpoenaed to court for their testimony and what they found?
I might pass the buck on that one.
Well, Chair Olson and members of the committee, I think that that's exactly what we're trying to accomplish with that extra language, the Washington State language that I mentioned. It would address that particular issue potentially, and I think we would need to work to kind of address that. If the concern is that we don't want members of the cert to be subject to that kind of subpoena, and to just leave it as the record stands as it is, so the case record that's compiled by the department in the investigation or in law enforcement's investigation, if I might speak for them just quickly, their police report is all going to be their police report. And I think that we would want it to remain that way. We wouldn't want the members of the cert team coming in to get subpoenaed and for litigation to testify about what they talked about in the cert proceeding. I think that that's what we're trying to get at.
And the Washington law would, if we got that in here, would protect CERT members?
We believe it would, and if it doesn't specifically, we'll make it so. If that's the, I mean, I would suspect that that's what we're trying to do with the questions I think you're posing. And I think certainly from my perspective as a participant on the CERT and others that would be coming to the table, I suspect that that would be something we would want to have as well. So it would, it would be in addition to the Washington language if it doesn't currently encompass that.
Stacy, just as a query from me, because I'm interested in it, has a CERT team ever come to a different conclusion than law enforcement's investigation? As to what happened,
Senator Olson, members of the committee, that's an interesting question because the purpose of the CERT committee isn't to make a finding about what perhaps caused a death, for instance, and so it wouldn't be to disagree with law enforcement. So if law enforcement or the medical examiner or the DA's office said, "Hey, we don't have enough to prove our case beyond a reasonable doubt," it wouldn't be for the CERT committee to say, well, you can clearly prove this and so you need to, or we're going to issue a finding, and that has not happened, and nor would it be appropriate, I think, for the CERT committee to do that. What would be appropriate, though, is to say, what are the systemic issues, which is the kind of the purpose of the CERT. What are the systemic issues that we can identify that happened, kind of regardless of what happens in the criminal case, that will improve safety for children in Oregon? And that's really the goal.
Then I'm going to.
Chair Olson.
Sure, certainly.
I think one of the things, if you go back and read all the certs, which I have, like, too many times, going back several years, the types of issues that you start to see emerge, it's less about the fatality itself at the end. The fact that the fatality happened is almost like bad luck. It is the signal that it's the signal event, and what tends to show a long series of issues and problems. So as you read through these and you read the history of the child's life in these certs that are published, what you'll start to see is a pattern emerging of, you know, what happens when there are reports of domestic violence? What happens when there are reports of neglect? What happens when the child makes certain disclosures? And how did the system respond in those cases? So frequently, if you read back through all of those certs, the recommendations themselves aren't necessarily about that singular event that led to the fatality. They are more looking at the circumstances that built up over a long period of time that created the environment in which there could be the perfect storm that led to a day when the child died. And again, that's why it's so important to do these, because it isn't just about preventing the fatalities. Some of the recommendations that have come out of the recent certs really go to how do we serve kids that hopefully aren't going to die but are suffering very much right now because of some systemic issues in the system that we have right now. So it's never going in to say the CERT, if you read the conclusions of the CERT, they never say Maya died because this person did this thing on that day. It will be Maya's experience as she moved through her life was this and this and this and this. And looking back, we see that, you know, this collateral resource should have been contacted, or she should have been taken to a doctor for a further assessment, or domestic violence resources should have been offered, or mental health services should have been offered, and these are the ways that we can do them in the future. It's not about the fatality itself. It's how do we make the system better to keep kids safer.
Well, a question for you, Senator, since you've studied these, does this open up DHS for negligence claim? If they were to subpoena the CERT and find out that this has been a consistent pattern that DHS hasn't taken care of?
Chair Olson, Senator Dimbrough, they wouldn't have to subpoena the CERT because the CERTs are published online. You can read all of them online. In recent years, they've had more significant detail. This is information that an attorney that's bringing a tort case could go and get and bring forward. I have seen one, although they didn't finish that CERT, I have there was a cert that started that didn't finish, that in a tort claim, the initial cert document was identified. I think that was HH. It was the Seaside.
It was just curiosity, because yeah. It sounds like you're going to do a parallel investigation, and you could open up DHS to Pandora's box, if you will.
And Chair Olson, members of the committee, I would argue if there are systemic issues that go unchecked and children are dying, the department should be held accountable for that. And that's why we have a court system.
Are there any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
So we're on the next bill.
Okay, we're going to close the hearing, the public hearing on Senate Bill 819, and we are going to open up a public hearing on 268. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 268.
Mr.
If you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 268 clarifies that the Department of Human Services investigation and certain notification requirements apply to reports of child abuse in school settings. It establishes requirements for investigations of alleged child abuse reports in non-family settings. It requires child abuse investigators in non-family settings to have specified relevant training. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. Would Mr. Ayers like to come forward? Oh, you're already here. And who else do we have, please?
Bob Jindev, Disability Rights Oregon.
Hey, Senator, would you like to start off?
Yes, please. Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm still Senator Sarah Gelser from Senate District 8. So Senate Bill 268 is just another excuse for me to spend time talking to Stacey Ayers. Who really you've probably heard today is a tremendous asset to the department, and I've really enjoyed the chance to work with him since I came in 2006, and we're just really lucky that he sticks it out here. So Senate Bill 268 is the continuation of a discussion that Stacy and Bob and I have been having for many sessions now, and this is the hole that we would like to address. This bill also requires amendment to get us where we need to go, partly because we probably can't afford to get all the way to where we need to go in this session. But right now, as you know, people are mandatory reporters of child abuse. And when you're a mandatory reporter of child abuse, that call goes to the child welfare hotline. The disconnect happens when the child welfare hotline closes the case at screening because they say they don't have the authority to investigate the abuse. And I can give you a couple of examples. I think Bob will be able to give you an example in a few minutes of a particularly egregious situation in a special education classroom where children were having joints dislocated, fingernails pulled out, being pinched, etc., in order to upset them to go home. And DHS said that they were unable to investigate because it wasn't the family. I have made those reports before. I had a dad that called and had gone to the school just to visit and found his child locked in one of those seclusion cells, small child, completely naked with a dog bowl of water on the floor, curled up in a fetal position and banging his head on the wall until he was bloody. And again, called DHS. DHS said, sorry, not a family member. We cannot investigate that. Then we all read last fall, I believe, in the Beaverton School District, there was an issue with some female students who reported sexual assault in the school. Principal said, hey, I made my mandatory report, but DHS said they couldn't do anything about it because it wasn't family members. So what the bill says at base is that DHS investigates child abuse. When I chaired the Education Committee for 6 years, we also looked at this because many of the statutes and policies for school districts, when they are looking at abuse that is perpetrated by members of the faculty or staff, be it coaches, teachers, classified staff who aren't all under a licensing board, right? Some of these people are volunteers. Some of these people don't have a licensing board. Their procedures defer to the investigation and determination of the Department of Human Services. They can never complete that process because the Department of Human Services does not do that. So that is what the bill intends to do, is to say, yes, if you receive an allegation of abuse, yes, you can investigate at a school. The second thing that it talks about is recognizing the unique circumstances in non-family abuse settings. So right now, we did change the law a few years ago for this very reason around child care. You may remember this. It was Ron Maurer, kind of, he was the representative from Grants Pass. in child care settings, there was an investigation. So now DHS can go and investigate these child abuse allegations. Dr. Richardson and I, sorry, those questions are hard. It gets tiring to be down here. Dr. Richardson and I had the opportunity to meet with a mom last summer whose child came home from child care covered from head to toe in bruises. The pictures were pretty horrific. Took him to the emergency room. DHS started the investigation, closed the investigation because the mom wasn't sending the kid back to child care. So the child was safe. The child had been protected. The problem was somebody else was moving into that child care slot. And when we met with the early learning division, because there wasn't a completion to that investigation and no determination, the early learning division couldn't do anything with that certification or license for that child care provider. So what this bill says is that when you are doing these investigations in non-family settings, you have to consider the safety not just of that children, but of all children in the setting, including future children that might come into the setting. And then it has some language that we've talked about as well around trauma-informed and age-appropriate investigations, being sensitive to the business needs of the organization that you are investigating, ensuring that your investigators are trained to do these things. So one of the things that Stacy and I have talked about is really trying to get a sense of the number of investigations that we would be talking about in terms of how expensive would this be? How much more of a workload are we looking at? We think we can get at some of that by going back through some of the closed at screening to see where some of the calls come from. And that's some of the language that we'd like to work on. I'm concerned about the fiscal. I personally would like to see us close this loophole and make sure that there are investigations when kids are in danger because, as Bob can attest, bad things happen to kids when a report is made and people are told it's closed at screening, they often assume that the behavior then is okay.
Question?
Please.
Yeah. When I was on the school board, there was child abuse with a high school student and a teacher, and it was a personnel matter. And so it was brought before in closed session to the school board. I have no idea if it was reported to DHS, because the school district I'm not sure if they suspended his license or revoked his teaching license. I don't think they revoked it because I think he ended up teaching out of state somewhere. So would this bill address that particular situation?
Chair Olson, Senator Moss Anderson, currently the way that we are handling any report that comes in where a teacher has been named as a perpetrator or an administrator has been named as a perpetrator, so in the circumstance that you have addressed, if that person did not have a child of their own, the report would be closed at screening, and then the report would be sent to Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and they are the body that has oversight over certification and the different administrators. So it would currently we would be able to address that. I think that there are some individuals that fall outside of the current structure and statute that aren't. There's no oversight over Teacher Standards and Practices Commission does not have oversight over them. For instance, coaches, unless they're a teacher also, or bus drivers, janitors, things like that. So all the there are a number of different kind of individuals that perform certain bodies of work that wouldn't, they don't have an oversight body that we can send the information to. And I can tell you, I know that this process works for the teachers and for administrators because I've chosen to handle every one of them specifically. And so when Teacher Standards and Practices Commission receives these, they contact me to get additional information. So I know that it happens. Historically, there have been some testimony provided that you know, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission was not receiving notification, but that was because the rule at the time didn't require it. And as soon as that came up as an issue, I went back and changed the rule so that we were sending every one of these over. And that will allow us, I think, to get kind of at a base level of, like, what the potential fiscal may be in a situation like this. And although I haven't started my kind of official testimony and I haven't even introduced myself again, I will, if that's okay. Stacy Ayers, again, Child Protective Services Manager for the department. Did that answer your question?
Well, I just want to make sure that the child's protected.
Yeah.
Referred to the proper resources.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen again, this state or any other state.
Yeah, and Chair Olson and Senator Monis Anderson, I think that is the ideal, right? Is that the child is protected from whatever happened, kind of regardless of who has oversight. And as Senator Gelser had mentioned, there would be some amendments to this bill as it's written, and I think the struggle that we're having as a department is kind of our oversight over some of these situations and how we go about kind of implementing and making sure that a child is protected and what that means in a school setting, for instance. And the way that we've tried to manage things through our rules as it stands, we're trying to use the agency that has oversight capacity over teachers and over other administrators to revoke licenses or revoke certification, teaching certificates, etc., so that that person has a record that shows that their teaching certificate has been revoked. And that is, again, I think it's been fairly effective. You know, there was a starting point where that wasn't happening, right? There was a date that wasn't happening. It is happening now with some regularity. And I can tell you that because, again, I get the request from Teacher Standards and Practices Commission about everything that we have related to them. So, yes, please.
And I think just building on your question about whether they're required to report, yes, that is a mandatory abuse report. It always has to go into the hotline. And that's what almost makes it worse. So, yes, Stacy fixed it for the licensed teachers. For certified staff, for coaches, for volunteers, TSPC doesn't have any authority over that. So our current system is the school is required to call and make a mandatory child abuse report. They do that. It's closed at screening. And then nothing else happens. That's a problem.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, Chair Olson, Senator Monis Anderson, that is a conversation that we've had with Teacher Standards and Practices Commission on the non-regulated staff. Mm-hmm. And so there is a hole there, clearly. And so what we tried to do with the, I'll call them regulated staff, the teachers and administrators, is to explain that the fact that we closed something does not, and I've actually had this conversation with the investigators at the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, who I'm going to refer to as TSPC because it's easier, that the fact that we've decided to close something at screening does not in any way negate the severity of what happened to a child and should not be interpreted as it's not concerning, it's not potentially criminal, which kind of gets to another issue in this, in that there's a whole other investigative body that currently is responsible for investigating allegations of child abuse, law enforcement. And in the circumstances that were raised by Senator Gelser, the child who was having parts of their body dislocated and being hurt so that they would act out and then potentially be dismissed from the classroom, those are criminal acts. Those are criminal acts that law enforcement has an obligation to investigate. Findings of which can be more severe than somebody having their certification revoked, right? You can potentially go to jail and or go to prison. Our finding is not going to be a prison sentence. Our finding is going to be a, we believe this happened, they get a founded, right? There's a founded disposition issued, or we can't make a determination that it happened, so it's unfounded or it's unable to determine. I guess, and the point to that is that at times I think there's an expectation that we take the place of law enforcement, and I just want to be clear that there's a whole other body of investigation that happens.
Good point.
Bob, please.
Senator Olson, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. I agree with everything I've heard, so I think I'll just tell a story because that's how we became involved in this issue. About 4 years ago, we received a phone call from a teacher's aide in a school program that served folks, children with disabilities, and she called to report that another teacher's aide in that program had been physically abusing a nonverbal child, and in order to discipline the child, and was doing it fairly, not routinely, but fairly often to other children as well. But particularly, she was concerned about this one child. She told us that she had made a complaint to Child Protective Services, as she's required to do, and she had complained to the administration, but that months had gone by and nothing had happened, at least that she was aware of. And so we as the Protection and Advocacy Organization are empowered to go into places like schools to do our own investigations in order to just try to find out what's happening. So in this case, we did that. We contacted Child Protective Services. We contacted school officials. We went in and talked to people in the school who would talk to us, gathered records, which we are authorized to get, in order to try to understand what had occurred. And our conclusions were as follows, is that the person who did complain to us made the complaint to DHS, made the complaint to the school administration. The school administration told us that they had asked the teacher's aide if there was anything going on. The person denied it. They didn't have any independent evidence about what was going on, and so they didn't do anything. When we spoke with Child Protective Services, they told us that they don't investigate these types of cases, and that under the under their own rules, they will refer to the police, and they will refer when a teacher is involved to teacher standards and training. So we went to talk to teacher standard and training, and they told us that they never investigated these cases because they would get a document from Child Protective Services that said that Child Protective Services was not going to investigate, and they had interpreted that to mean that there was no abuse. So we had a meeting with all the parties, and they basically said, oh, well, that's not what it means when we send you this, so let's change how we do things. So that was good. We made some progress there. However, everyone agreed that this particular arrangement did not deal with teachers' aides, school bus drivers, janitors, or other types of non-teacher or administrative personnel who were in the schools. We spoke to law enforcement in the jurisdiction, and they told us that, as a general matter, they do not investigate any matter that doesn't arise to a very serious crime. They just don't have the resources to do so, and they have the discretion to decide what to investigate and what not to investigate. So our own investigation revealed to us, at least, that there was strong indication that abuse had occurred. And we do not have authority to bring law enforcement actions or anything else, but that was our own conclusion. So at least we felt that, particularly for a child who's particularly vulnerable, who cannot report things to parents, cannot report things to other students or administrators or teachers, that these kids are extremely vulnerable and there just wasn't a way to get to an independent, skilled investigation to find out what was going on and take appropriate steps. And so that's why we are here to support this legislation.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, just one real quick one. Because that will expand your duties, this would be how cost us how much?
Cut to the chase. Chair Olson, Senator Monson-Anderson, that is a great question. We're not sure right now because it is not a body of work that, as we've been articulating, that we've done. And, you know, the way that the statute reads, 419V020, it says if the Department of Human Services or a law enforcement agency receives a report of child abuse or neglect, including but not limited to, and it talks about school premises, that one or the other shall investigate. It doesn't say you both have to, or it doesn't say you have to confirm that one is not, and then you have to if they're not going to do it. And so there is no question that there's a gap in this. And I would never sit here and argue that I think things are fine the way they are. As far as the fiscal, the struggle here is trying to identify exactly what that looks like. Again, it's not a body of work that we've been doing unless the teacher themselves has their own child. And those were the cases, and kind of back to what Mr. Jundep had mentioned, those are the cases that were being sent over to Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, the ones that we were assigning to investigate because the teacher had their own child to let them know. So, so again, I think we have a starting point with all the reports that get sent to TSPC. That's one element. My hope is that we'll have the opportunity to work with law enforcement because I know that they have databases that I believe that they have databases that would allow for them to go in and look and see where the report emanated from. So kind of regardless of perpetrator type, if the abuse happened at school, there's nothing in here that says it had to have been by a janitor or a bus driver or a teacher. It could have been another student. So it may be a way for us to kind of narrow down exactly what we're talking about, the potential numbers, right? While I don't believe, I don't know that that's the intent of the legislation, is to get at, you know, one student who's perhaps sexually assaulting another student, and, you know, that's not being addressed potentially by law enforcement for a variety of reasons, and some of them very good ones, I imagine, right? But it does capture that, and I think it's just a way for us to kind of start working with our law enforcement partners about how many are they thinking that they have, and how many do we think we have, because at some point, what it feels like is that the intent is the department is going to be investigating these. And the workload that will come with that is probably fairly significant. I think that there are a lot that actually don't come to our attention now. So, and perhaps because they've been told we don't investigate these, right? So if the schools are already kind of under the, operating under the belief that we could call it into child welfare, but they're not going to investigate it, and so maybe they just call law enforcement. I don't know, but I suspect that could be something that happens. So there's just an unknown number that we've got to try to get our arms around, because otherwise I feel like this has the potential to be a really large burden that the department is not in a position to just kind of undertake and go.
And just one follow-up.
Sure.
My concern is this is telling you have to do it, and would hate to have something in if you're not going to be able to do it. We need to get to the point where we can fund education adequately, we can fund DHS adequately, and So that would be a concern. Okay, thank you.
And I think the one last thing that, can I borrow this for a second?
You can have
thank
it.
You. The one last thing that I'd add, when we're working with council to draft the bill, the legislative council asked why we needed the bill, because the argument was the law already says that. The current statute says if the Department of Human Services or a law enforcement agency receives a report of child abuse, the department or the agency shall immediately, and then it goes on to the cause of the investigation. It does not say if the Department of Human Services or a law enforcement agency receives a report of child abuse, except for if it's in a school. So, I mean, that exception isn't there. That said, the ability to do things well is an issue. We certainly have a department that is extraordinarily underfunded. We can't do the work, or the department cannot do the work that's necessary if you're at 83% of caseload, and that would assume that at 83% of caseload you're fully staffed because people want to keep working for you and they're not turning over because the work is so hard and they're underpaid and they're undertrained. So that, I think, if we really want to make kids safe, the most important thing we can do is more caseworkers, a centralized child welfare hotline, and better investment in the number of caseworkers, trainings, and assessments, even if that means that we have to step away from some of the bells and whistles kinds of things like differential response. We need to be investing in that base things. You got to have the running water before you put a hot tub in the backyard.
And if I may, Chair Olson, please, and members of the committee, the only, just because you reminded me, if this were legislation that we really wanted to kind of force the hands of the department and law enforcement agencies to say, look, if a report comes in, you guys investigate this, and as you're investigating, you figure out what your roles are going to be. You would probably put that in a different section of the statute, and currently, the way it's written, it's in section 1, 419B020. And really, if you wanted it to be a mandate, you would put it in 419B020 sub 2, which, in reference to what Senator Gelser referred to earlier, talks about the mandate to investigate allegations of abuse that occur in a child care setting. And so that legislation was passed several years ago, and it basically says exactly what I've said. If that comes in and it happens in a child care facility, the department and law enforcement must investigate. And they get together and they figure out what their roles are going to be. There's not a lot of flexibility in that. So, you know, if it was to be a mandate, if that were the expectation, that's where it would need to be. And I think we would want to work on language about that for all the reasons we've talked about. So,
and we still have to do a work session. Just
there you go.
Just asking them. Okay, we're going to, if there's no other testimony, anybody else like to testify?
Yes.
Please?
Yeah.
We have very,
very, yeah.
Small amount of time. 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Okay.
2 minutes, too. So.
If that's okay, I imagine that
Mr. Chair,
they may ask you
to respond. I'm not running away from you, Monique. I'm just getting up to the
What are you want to testify on?
I want to testify on 819.
That's up to the new chair. That's you.
Of course. Yes.
How does this work?
Okay.
On 819? Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on 268. And reopen the public hearing on 819.
We don't have 5 minutes.
Yeah, and Monique, you've got to do it to 3 because we have to be out of here in 6.
Right.
Okay.
So I just want to testify on 819. I'm Monique Molina for the record. I'm a nobody. I'm just here to speak about 819 and my experience. From what I have seen, I guess I'm just alarmed because of what I've read in the paper. There's an article that 819 was tacked to. And I guess I just got concerned because it implies that, to me anyway, it implies that children at home are unsafe and that parents are harming their children intentionally. That I guess I just want to share my story in the sense. And I spent 19 years in care. I grew up in foster care since I was born to age 19. There I moved around. It's the same story you've always heard, to like dozens of homes, to institutions, to whatnot. I guess I grew up in an environment where it was like a foster mill. It wasn't really a home. I think after I left care, I had a child at 21. I was in college. I was young. And I don't know why this is so hard for me. So I exited out of the system without a support system. Like I said, I wasn't raised in a family environment. And I had this kid, and I just became a single mom. I didn't really know what to do. And I found myself struggling just to keep him and to keep him safe. I know you're looking at the clock. I'm trying to make it as fast as
I
can.
No, I am. And I'm,
this is really hard for me, but I just hope that I get those 5 minutes because everyone's gone.
Right. And I want to ask you a question really quick, because I've had the chance to sit with you and hear the story, and I'm happy to schedule an informational hearing if you don't want to be rushed. So you can talk now, or I can
It's
better.
It's okay.
For you.
Okay. It's okay. And I guess in short, just my experience in foster care for the 19 years really impacted my ability to be a mother. And that it often put my kid in unsafe situations. Being a single mother, not being able to find housing, being a young first-time orphan mother, not having family to help me, kind of backed me in that corner. I think at 25, I was still in college, and I had a mental health crisis. I didn't really process what had happened to me in care. I kind of just kept trying to roll on, and then it caught up to me. And I called CPS on myself, and I think that was the scariest thing I ever did, because I was afraid to lose him, but I loved him, and I knew I needed help. And they told me they couldn't help me, and that they had to wait until abuse had happened. But I knew as a mother that I instinctually felt that I was at the point where I could no longer keep him safe, and I was under circumstances in which not all mothers have to go through, being orphaned or being single parent or coming from these adverse populations. And so I ended up having to choose to find a way to put him into foster care with someone I knew. I was able to get my mental health treatment. But I'm still struggling. I'm still at risk. And I think I just want to say, when it comes to figuring out and deciding what abuse and neglect is, are we making the room for populations that are orphans or that are single moms or first-time mothers or young mothers that just don't know how the hell to do it? And do we... is it best to have your child removed? Does that help the situation? From my experience of being an orphan and an at-risk mother from growing up in foster care, I think that the best thing would be to keep your child at home and to try to get the supportive services that you need, to have a place to be able to come out and talk about your abuse and about needing help without being in fear of your child taken from you. I think your bill is good, Sarah. I just think that the things that could be tacked onto the back of it, and that people need to understand, is that parents mean well, and I meant well, and I have good intentions, and we must decipher between our abilities versus our efforts. Do I have the ability to be a mother all the time? Well, I'm a mother that needs a mother. I still need a mother. But do I make the effort? Hell yeah, I do. And I work my ass off and I do it. But I need a little help. I need somebody to call and check on me and to know that I'm doing things right. And I think that... I think that it's hard when you don't even have it as an option and you have no place to turn. And so if we must really take a look at the system and talk about child abuse and neglect, I think that we just need to not fasten the belts on, oh, how can we crack down on them sooner, but how can we help them? And is there love there? And is there something that we can help them work around to keep this family together? Because you need family for the rest of your life. You can't do it by yourself, and I've tried. And I think, in conclusion, we need to reevaluate the Oregon safety model. Is it trauma-informed? Does it include these diverse populations? Does it make room for single, young, first-time orphan mothers? It does not. Go and read it. It does not. I think that more families need services. I think that people need somebody to call. I think that we should be able to come out to our therapist about family violence. I think we need to stop criminalizing it. It just happens, and it's raising kids isn't easy, and it's not easy to do by yourself. And so I just beg you guys to not have this bill result in the removal of children from their mothers, because they need them for the rest of their life. And I've included, if it helps you understand, because I'm a visual learner, I guess I put together a picture book so you can understand that. Are we looking at, are we targeting in on these few bad times, or are we overseeing the bigger picture, which is there's more good than bad? And so we need to really reconsider those ideas, and it's serious, it's upsetting, and I just hope that you guys all take that into account. And I guess I appreciate your time, and I don't know if there's any questions for me.
So, Monique, thank you for coming up. And we can make more time later. All of you have not had the opportunity to meet Monique. I have. She, or meeting her son, and meeting your son, it's clear that you're doing a really good job, even though it's really, it's hard. And I'm glad you're in the building, and I'm glad that you keep speaking up. And as I've told you, every time you come, you kind of rock my world and change the way that I think about things. And there's a lot that you have to say and the story that you've, especially around parenting and that transition, that I hope we can bring you back to talk more about, because you have expertise that people don't have. And it's hard to sit up and say those things, and I'm grateful to you for being willing to do it.
Yeah, thanks for listening to me. I hope I wasn't too much. But it's important that you know. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 819. Let's just carry over the work session to Wednesday. So we're going to carry over the work session. Sorry, DHS, on Senate Bill 104. We really are going to move it. And with that, we are adjourned.